This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commmavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 337 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by a couple of co-hosts. First, we have Brian Coleman, our associate producer. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Max. It's really great to be here. I was gone for a few weeks, and there was a little bit of concern if I'd actually be here tonight or not.
Well, we're glad to have you. We're also glad to have Max Trescott, author and certified flight instructor.
Hello, I understand I'm substituting for Rob Mark, though he might be joining us later. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're not sure. You know, you never really know with Rob what's going to happen, other than he might be late, so we'll see if he shows up.
He's probably off talking with Megyn Kelly again. You know how he is.
Yeah, he kind of likes to do that. So
exactly. We're just playing second fiddle to him, I think.
All right. Well, our guest this episode is Steve Taylor. Now, Steve's a graduate of the Citadel, the Military College of South Carolina. He served 6 years as a pilot in the U.S. Air Force with service in Vietnam, and he had a long flying career, retiring ultimately as an international airline captain. His autobiography is Wheels Up, Skyjinks in the Jet Age, which has got a lot of great true life stories told with more than a little bit of humor. We'll be talking about that coming up. But Steve, we want to welcome you to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Now, we asked you to come because we understand that you have lots and lots of great experiences in stories. So we're going to look forward to hearing some of those coming up.
Great. I enjoy telling them.
We're going to give you that opportunity. Also coming up, we have some news from the past week. We also have a history segment from Jamie Dodson. He's going to tell us about the Cessna 172. And we have a lot of great feedback and topics in the recent listener mailbag. So with all that, we should get started right away. First with the aviation news. Is everyone ready?
Ready. Ready from the West.
First story comes from Yahoo.com. This is Northrop surprises with new design for U.S. Air Force trainer. Well, the U.S. Air Force, they want to replace the, I guess you'd call them the aging T-38 Talons with a new two-seat jet trainer. So this is all under the TX program, where they're looking to purchase, at least 350 planes, but there are other variants, other uses being talked about that might expand that number significantly. Northrop Grumman has a prototype that they plan to fly later this year. It's a clean sheet design. And I guess, Brian, there's others who are kind of circling around this requirement from the Air Force.
Boeing, Lockheed, Textron, Skeld Composites, they're in here helping out as well.
Yeah, this is a big program. I think it's been delayed a couple of times due to sequestration, budget issues, and things like that. But so this is kind of something to watch. We'll see if this actually goes forward. Northrop Grumman is kind of, they look like they're out ahead of the pack, at least in terms of creating a clean sheet of paper aircraft that can move forward.
Yeah, I looked for pictures of this, and I couldn't find any. So were you able to find any?
No, I was not. And I also looked. So maybe we'll put that out to our listeners if anyone has access to these aircraft that Northrop Grumman are putting together, that would be something maybe you could pass along to us and we could take a look.
You know, the thing that surprised me about this is just how long the T-38's been in service. Yeah. I didn't realize it was first introduced in 1961 and production ended in 1972. So, yeah, I mean, they kind of waited around 40 plus years to replace this thing. And I'm sure part of it's just attrition. You know, they've had more than 200 aircraft losses, which is not surprising when you figure a training over 50 years, you're bound to lose aircraft.
And I think also that, you know, with the fifth generation fighters that are out there, you need a trainer that at least, you know, lets you do some of the capabilities that the fifth gen fighters can do. I mean, obviously they can't replicate them, but at least from a training standpoint, you need to be able to prepare pilots for the new fighters. And if you're trying to do that with a trainer that's that old, that obsolete technologically, it makes it a little tough.
Hey, you Steve, Steve, with all the aircraft that you've flown, was the T-38 one of them?
No, it wasn't. It was a new airplane when I went through pilot training. I got my basic training in the T-33. The friends and other pilots that went through the T-33, some of them flew the hottest things out there. Some of them flew the F-104, and some of them flew... One guy even went to the NASA flight school and got his test pilot rating. So, you know... Flying is flying. I knew guys that went through on the T-38. It was the class right after my class that they had the first class of T-38s. So, you know, we would have loved to have flown them because they were hot. And the T-33 wasn't supersonic, and it was a very old airplane, but I loved it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Steve, what do you remember most about the T-33?
You guys probably never heard of this, but it had what they call a coffee grinder on it, where they did oral null approaches. Have you ever heard of those?
Sure, yeah. You're talking about where you fly down the center and you try and null out the Morse code on the left or the right?
That's correct.
And you're right. I've heard of them. I never heard of one.
Well, it was what the students said was an almost impossible approach, but we were trained... But not trained well on that because they knew that that was a thing of the past. But it had ILS on it, and it had the basic equipment, all the basic equipment that an airplane has. You know, it had vertical velocity and airspeed and altitude and artificial horizon, and what else do you need? You know, it's what you got to have to fly an airplane.
Coffee grinder, wasn't that the big knob on the you know, how you tune the radio?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It had a little handle on it. It had a crank, and you constantly crank that thing one way or another to stay in the null position, because on one side you'd get too far one side, and you'd hear the blending of the two signals. And if you got in the middle, they'd cancel each other out.
Yeah, it was like a Morse code A on one side and an N on the other side.
Right, but. Yeah, I loved the T-33. I liked it a lot better than the T-37, which was the basic trainer that I went through on. And you know, it was around for a long time. I guess they may still be training on the T-37.
Well, that was the tweet, wasn't it, the 37?
Yeah, we used to call it Screaming Mimi.
I think the tweets are retired. I saw a large number of them in a boneyard down in Tucson, Arizona years ago.
And incidentally, both those airplanes did some service in Vietnam. The T-38... went over as F-5s, and the Tweet went over as some kind of special operations airplane. Not very many of them, but they were over there.
All right. Well, let's go from looking at the past to looking into the future with our next item. This is about drones, and I just want to mention this briefly. But the FAA has finally released the NPRM, the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, for small UAVs, or UAS as the FAA calls them. This is something that's been eagerly anticipated. And what this is the FAA's proposal for the regulations that would apply to commercial use, not recreational use, but commercial use of drones under 55 pounds in weight, and under the NPRM, the FAA describes the requirements as requiring line of sight, no first-person view, flying these under 500 feet AGL, only in daylight hours, also a 100-mile-per-hour top speed. So this answers also a number of questions that people had, such as, will you have to be a pilot, a certified pilot to fly small drones? And the answer is no, you don't. Will you have to certify the airworthiness of the drones? And the answer from the FAA, the proposal is no, you will not. There is a knowledge test that you will have to take in order to do this. And this will give you an operator's certificate based on your performance of the knowledge test. So it's moving forward a little bit. I see Rob Mark has joined us first. Hi, Rob.
Good evening. I'm sorry I am late. Ian, you got to the best story about the drones. I was going to try not to laugh when I heard about the knowledge test.
Well, I know that you've had some comments about this move by the FAA, the NPRM. Were you surprised by it? Have you had an opportunity to kind of look at what the proposal involves?
Well, I did, actually. And, you know, as I always say, I really like the idea of drones. I think they're going to do some astounding important jobs in the world. I really do. And I only have one concern, that, and you'll see that it was not addressed in any of the details that the FAA released, which I still thought was a little odd that they did that at 11:30 on a Sunday morning.
Yeah, very strange.
Yeah, well, that's another story. But the part that's not addressed anywhere is the fact that they have no idea how they are going to keep drones away from airplanes, other than saying, Max Trescott, when you buy that damn drone, don't you fly that thing near an airport now, you hear?
Well, you know, there is something that differs regarding permission to fly in airspace. So in the past, I know a number of us here on the show fly drones. I think they're great fun. I've learned a lot doing it.
Yeah.
But the current rules say that I can fly in a Class Delta airspace. I just have to notify the tower and notify the airport operator, which in our case here would be the county, that I'm planning to do it. Now, that changes under the NPRM. So when those rules eventually are finalized, maybe 2 years from now, we'll actually have to call and get permission. So if everybody is calling and getting permission to operate in a particular area, well, then they're going to know where everybody is, and that's going to help a little bit in terms of separation. And I know that there's a lot of work going on in sensors. You look at some of the new kind of cutting-edge drones, and a lot of them have kind of a detect and avoid type of sensors being advertised, so they can, you know, sense other aircraft out there and avoid them. So I think a lot of work is going on in this area, and by the time these rules get finalized and promulgated, you know, probably 2 years from now, I think the drones probably will be able to avoid each other to a greater extent than they can today.
Well, I hope they can avoid each other. That's nice. I hate to see a drone smack into another one, but, you know, again, I'm only reacting to what I did not read in the details, and that was the fact that there was no mention of the detect and avoid technology that, honestly, having spoken to some of the folks at the RTCA, which was the old, essentially an industry working group that looks into these kinds of issues dealing with technology, they're years away from being able to perfect anything from in their own estimation. So somebody else comes up with something, I don't care how they do it. I really don't. I just don't want one coming through my window.
And NASA's been working on this very actively for the last couple of years. They've got two different groups at NASA Ames, one which is further ahead, which is working on separation of drones above flight level 180, so above 18,000 feet, and another group which is working on the low-level drones, the ones below 400 and 500 feet. I don't think they're quite as far along. But we might look at getting one of those NASA folks on here sometime, because I know there's a lot of work going on in this area.
Yeah, there sure is, and by a variety of different companies, including, for example, Precision Hawk, who is talking about a technology that actually is a low-cost approach that uses the cellular phone network as the communications method for this. But there are, a lot of folks looking at this because, like you say, Rob, this is a key aspect of it. I think the FAA is looking at sort of an incremental approach, and that's an increment that hasn't been taken yet. That's also something I think that, you know, puts the Amazon.com and others on hold in terms of package delivery, because you obviously need, you know, sense and avoid if you're going to have automated package delivery. David Nye gives some initial thoughts on the NPRM over at the UAVDigest.com, episode 81. So if you want to listen to us talk about that, that's the UAVDigest.com/81. And then the other thing is that this kicks off a 60-day comment period for the public. And this is the time for those who have a vested interest one way or another in all this to take a really serious look at the NPRM. Think about comments that you would want to provide the FAA, and then do that. The important thing to know is the docket number, which is FAA-2015-0150, and you can find that at regulations.gov. Just search for that docket number.
Sure, and if I can just add one other thing, the RTCA group that I mentioned is the same group that is part of what Max Truscott was talking about, looking at the high-level drone issue. I honestly was not aware that there was another one looking at the lower-level one. In fact, what I just found out recently was that the high-altitude one does not include the weight of the category that we're talking about with this new FAA rule, because the new FAA rules looking potential rules looking at the less than 55-pound category, and apparently the ones up at high altitude that Max first mentioned is greater in size than that. In fact, I think they're using the – what is it that NASA owns either, Max? It's a Predator or something?
Global Hawk?
Global Hawk.
I don't remember, but you're right. They do have some of those.
Yeah, so they get to play with those things all day long. But anyway, okay, enough.
And there's one other aspect I was going to mention. I had totally missed one aspect of this. Everybody talks about, yes, the new NPRM says that people are going to have to take a knowledge exam, which would be like the current pilot exams. You probably pay $150, go to a computer testing service. But what I haven't heard anybody mention is that they also say in the NPRM that you have to obtain an unmanned aircraft operator certificate with a UAS rating. Now, an operator certificate, there are a couple different ways they could go with this. They could actually require flight testing, you know, with an examiner, or they could do it similar to the ground instructor certificate, which essentially says you have to pass a knowledge exam and then, you know, get a local FAA inspector to sign off, basically, that you can get the certificate. So it'll be interesting to see exactly what they have in mind for what it will take to get a aircraft operator certificate. They also say that you have to be vetted by the TSA, which I know in our case means that none of us would pass.
Yeah, especially Brian these days.
Yeah, but just think about that, Max. You could have a whole other category of potential flight instructor certificate under your belt.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, why don't we move on? This is something that, again, we'll talk about a lot over at the UAVDigest.com, and we'll touch on here from time to time because it impacts pilots. It impacts the airlines.
Could we use another word other than impact?
Impact, right, exactly. Right.
How about effect?
Collision.
Bad choice. Bad word choice. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Hey, let's move on. We have an item from Gizmag. This is about the airport terminal being planned for China. China's got some big things. It's got the tallest pair of towers. It's got the world's largest building. And now we're looking at what could be the world's largest airport terminal.
It's actually the world's largest singular one logo. If you look at the picture, it just reminds me of, no one's familiar with singular one. I can't believe that. The old cell phone company that's out of business.
Yes,
their terminal looks exactly like their logo.
Well, this article in Gizmag, I couldn't believe how they described that. They said that this resembles the form, this is a quote from the article, of a massive mutant starfish. But this thing is big. This thing is 7.5 million square feet. This is at a new airport that's reportedly to be completed in 2018. And this thing is just huge.
And only costs slightly less than $13.8 billion.
And you know what what did you call it? A monster mutant starfish?
A massive mutant starfish.
And you would know what one of those looks like how exactly?
Got me.
Okay. Sounds like a superhero of some kind.
Steve, when you were flying for the airline, how important was the airport facilities to you as a pilot? Did you care? How did that impact you?
It wasn't as important as the controllers at the various, primarily approach control and tower operators at the various airports. And we had pretty much identified the ones we liked and the ones we didn't like. But, you know, as far as the airports were concerned, it wasn't a major thing. I do have a question about that thing, though, is in looking at it, I came across an article that said that the largest airport in the world was being planned in Istanbul. Uh-oh. I wonder if you guys ever heard anything about that. It seemed like a bit of a conflict there. I don't know if it was a semantics thing where they had the largest single terminal building and the other one has the largest airport or what it was, but I did come across that.
That's interesting. Yeah, I don't know. You know how people claim records. It's always easy to kind of redefine what it is that you're measuring in a way that makes you look the best. And I don't know. Maybe there's a little bit of that going on here. I don't know.
Yeah, square feet of the building versus runway space or square acres of the airport facility itself.
There was some indication that they may have been talking about the terminal building that was not where the gates were. So if you say like the China one, it's everywhere, you know, the gates and this one was a lot more separated and had a big terminal. Its design, the one in Istanbul, is totally different from the one in China.
Well, the renderings of this China terminal are pretty impressive, obviously very expansive and open. I guess what really counts, though, for the passengers, the flying public, is what do they put in that and, you know, how do they design the interior and what facilities, what accommodations do they make for the passengers?
Restaurants and moving sidewalks.
Yeah, well.
And also travel time to downtown Beijing. You know, you look at some of these airports, Narita in Tokyo, you know, you spend more than an hour getting to downtown. And to me, that's a big issue for any new airport if it's too far away from the city.
Oh, yeah. If you can get from Narita to downtown Tokyo in an hour, that's really good. My experience there has been mostly 2 hours minimum.
Yeah. You asked me about the airports the impact and ones that – but there was one airport that I felt like was unusually bad. was the Washington Dulles Airport. And of course, that airport was built by the FAA, which would make sense that it wouldn't work right. But
so, what was it about Dulles that?
Dulles they designed the terminal completely separate from where the airplanes parked, and then they had these giant people movers.
Yes.
That would drive up to the terminal and pick the passengers up and take them to the airplane.
It's like a shuttle service kind of a thing,
right? And it was it always took a lot more time than other airports. And then if you had some reason, and there always was, I'm not say always, but a lot of times there was a reason that they had to go back to the terminal. Then they had to wait for that thing to go back and get whatever they wanted, you know, because there was no way to travel between the gates and the airport terminal. And so if somebody left their handbag or whatever it was they had to get, you know, they either missed their flight or left their handbag. And so it was very cumbersome, and it always took more time than other airports.
So I guess we can say with respect to this terminal in China that it's not really size that matters, it's what you do with it.
Yeah, and I particularly looked at that thing and wondered about the design, and it looked to me like it would work okay. I think they've thought it through.
It's not really the size that matters. It's what you do with it.
And our next news story.
Max, that was a joke. That's pretty good.
That was just too easy.
No, in fact, though, Steve, I remember those crazy things, and they were on stilts. I can't remember what they were.
Well, they actually, those things were very expensive, too.
Yeah, weren't they like about $1 million a copy?
Yeah, something like that back then. And
they're still there. They still use them.
Yeah.
We had a story here just a couple of months ago where one of them ran over a tug and killed the driver. So they're also dangerous.
Oh. Well, the stilts was – the reason it cost so much was it had this accordion-type mechanism where it would come down, and when it was running around on the concrete – it would be a lot lower, and then this accordion thing would rise, would bring the passenger cabin up to the level of the airplane, and then it would drive up to the door with this thing sticking way up in the air, because some of those doors are really high, and somebody had a good time designing that thing.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, and I think that's the only airport in the world that does that. I mean, that tells you how popular an idea it is. Yeah.
I think it is the only one.
All right, well, let's talk about Southwest. Let's talk about rewards programs, talking about the passenger experience a little bit.
Let's move on to the next story, because I could just take the rest of the show and vent and rant about frequent flyer programs.
You don't want to talk about Southwest, huh?
No, that's fine. I'm just so phenomenally opinionated over frequent flyer programs.
Well, Southwest is changing theirs, and this is effective April 17th. And the reward points are going to depend on the destination, the time, the day of travel, the demand, and some other factors. We've seen other airlines that have made changes as well. Delta switched from miles traveled to dollars spent, and United also plans to switch to something similar. There's a lot of changes. I mean, you always used to be able to kind of rely on the miles, the points, the rewards program.
On them for what?
Well, for consistency and being able to, you know, to get your points and use them to take flights. But both of those are changing, and it's not the same situation.
I never felt that way with, of course, the only ones I ever really had were American and Southwest, and I almost never felt that way on American, because whenever I wanted to go from Chicago to, I don't know, let's just pick a spot like Washington.
It's
I
because
would have
you
to
wanted
go
to
go through Houston, or I mean, not Houston. I would have to go through Dallas. And I'm sorry, what did you say, Brian? I didn't hear that.
I said it's because you wanted to travel over Christmas. That's the reason why space wasn't available.
Okay. No, but the one thing, you know, and I agree with you that the story is obviously germane, because all of the airlines are changing their frequent flyer programs to one degree or another. But until the day comes when Southwest changes from their current plan, which is if there's an open seat and you have the miles, you got it, baby. And it's not like that with the other carriers. And when Southwest changes that, they will lose me. But right now, they haven't, for that reason alone.
I remember the old days when flying on United, they would actually mail a certificate for the miles earned. It almost looked like a yep. stock certificate or something. I think I might still have some of those somewhere.
I think I do too.
Oh, I've used all mine. I was king in maximizing the usage of all of those certificates. So
Yeah, and the sad thing is I don't know that I've ever used any of my United miles, so I have a pile of them, and they become worth less and less every year. What could you do? What was it, 20,000 miles for like a ticket originally, and now it
originally
can be as much as 50 or 75,000, depending upon, you know, all the terms and conditions for a domestic flight now.
Mm. And it's worse internationally, and again, this is where I get to go off for hours talking about this. And just this past October, I cashed in a whole bunch of frequent flyer miles and flew to Taiwan, and I flew on EVA. And it took twice as many miles to fly on EVA as it would have if I flew on United. The problem is United doesn't fly there, so I had no choice in getting there. But the nice part was I did have enough miles to cash in and fly in comfort, and I, you know, did it in business, and that was really nice. And I'm actually working on a story about the PR agency that contacted me as a result of the trip report that I wrote on them, and I find that kind of fascinating, and I'm so looking forward to getting time to actually finishing that. But anyway, Rob, I kind of disagree with you. There is value in the miles. I completely agree with Max T that the value is becoming less and less, and you almost have to spend them the same year that you acquire them, because you're not guaranteed that they'll be around the following year, or you're guaranteed that they'll be worth half as much. And now with this change that Southwest is making, you'll earn half as many based on when you buy your ticket or when you go to fly or where you're going or, you know, all the other restrictions that they've put on it. So they've changed these from frequent flyer programs to maximize revenue programs. And I just wish they would call them what they are.
I have never heard the co-host sound as grumpy as this topic. None of us likes this. It's pretty funny.
Wait. I just want to say one thing. I don't think I said that they weren't worth anything. In fact, I didn't read that Southwest was taking that big a hit on, you know, I mean, that their points are going to be worth half of what they were or something like that.
No, you're going to earn half as many.
Again, it depends on when you fly.
Correct, exactly.
Yep. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess I don't even look at them that close. But, I mean, they are – imagine if right now there was a new law that, you know, part of the 107, part 107 that's going to be for the UAVs had an add-on at the bottom that said, and oh, by the way, in January of 2018, all frequent flyer programs at all U.S. domestic carriers will be terminated. So take them now because they're going to die. Well, if there were none, how would that change the industry? Think about that. I mean, what would the airlines have to hound you with to try to get you to fly United or Delta or American or anybody else? I don't know.
They could offer good service. Oh, wait, no.
Oh,
sorry.
Come on. Let's not get crazy here.
I didn't mean to make a joke.
But all right, just one last thing. You did hear that line that Michael O'Leary spouted off about, it was last summer, I think. No, last spring, about customer service and all that. And he said that if I'd realized that customer service could so impact the bottom line of my airline, I would have started being nicer to people years ago. But okay, well, anyway. All right.
That's pretty funny. Ryanair, right?
Well, again, we're speaking with Steve Taylor. Steve, again, thanks for coming on the show. Your flying career goes back many, many years, and even into the war in Vietnam. What were you flying back in those days?
Well, in Vietnam, I flew C-130s. When I went to work with Delta, I originally trained as an engineer on a DC-6, which really goes back a ways, And there's three airplanes that I flew that are in the Smithsonian. So if you want to feel,
oh, is that right? Yeah. Which three?
Well, the DC-6 is in there, and also the J-3 Cub and the T-33 trainer.
So what was it like flying the C-130s? Was it a bunch of hotshot kids out there enjoying the skies? What was it like?
Well, it was an interesting airplane. You know, the C-130 first was manufactured in 1956. They've got kids flying them today. Lots of people flying them today. The airplane's older than they are.
Sure.
Because they're still flying those things all over the place. It was a great airplane. I flew it in Tactical Air Command, and our primary mission was hauling anything that could be hauled. And we flew into unprepared surfaces, and we dropped troops. And when I was in Vietnam, we just hauled just about anything that needed hauling. And fact of the matter is, I had one story of one time when I came close to a bad situation when we were hauling water, and I had a tank of 2,000-gallon tank of potable water going into a PSP airport that was under attack part of the time, the PSP, by the way, is perforated steel planking that they made the airstrips out of sometimes.
Oh, yes.
When they needed to come up with an airfield, a temporary airfield, all of a sudden. And this airfield had no tower. And so our instructions were, we knew how long the PSP was, but when we left, so we knew we could land there, but we were supposed to fly over the airport and get a green light if everything was okay and they hadn't been overrun by the VC. And so we flew over, and the first thing we noticed is there was a Jeep in the middle of the runway, and there was a Patton tank about two-thirds of the way down the runway. So we flew over, and they gave us the green light. Well, obviously, we couldn't land, and so we flew over several more times, and each time they'd give us the green light. And finally, they got the message, and somebody went out there and moved the Jeep. And then we realized that the tank was broke down in about two-thirds of the way down the runway. So then we just started the discussion about whether we could land with the tank there. and this was an exercise, and it comes back to your thought about young guys running around having a good time, because we were on a tactical emergency. And when you're on a tactical emergency, and that was through that part of the war, that was used a lot. And a tactical emergency was that you could do anything you had nerve enough to do. There was no regulations. And the idea was that to get a lot more things accomplished without being burdened with regulations. So I decided I could make an assault landing in there. Well, assault landing is really, in fact, I was good at assault landings. I'd practiced them a lot. But what I didn't realize was, about an hour before we got there, maybe 2 hours before we got there, they'd had 2 inches of rain in an hour's time. So when we set up to do the assault landing, the way you do assault landing is you descend the airplane at about 1,500 feet a minute or a little less, and you hit the ground, and you don't try to flare at all. You just hit the ground at that sink rate. And that in itself dissipates a lot of energy. And at the same time you hit the ground, you go into full reverse thrust. And if everything works out well, you stop in a very short distance. But in our case, as soon as we went into reverse thrust and put the brakes on, we had no brakes. Because the PSP, the mud came up through it, and it was so slick that that the brakes, the anti-skid just constantly cycled. And
you're heading towards this tank.
We're heading towards the tank with the gun barrel aimed at us. and then to make matters worse, the props sucked that water out of that PSP and engulfed the airplane, and so we couldn't see. And so there was just this big cloud going down the runway. And we didn't know how close we were getting to the tank. Well, when we stopped, the gun barrel of that tank was only 5 feet from the windshield.
Wow.
And there was two soldiers there that had been at war, and they were going back to Saigon because they had some R&R coming, and they refused to get on our airplane.
I don't blame them.
They were said they'd wait for the helicopter to come in.
Because they'd seen you fly, right?
Yeah.
Oh, my. So when you what was the transition like to flying for the airline? Was that kind of a letdown after such excitement flying for the military?
Actually, flying for the airline in those days was a dream job. Hmm. You know, it's still fun, but it was fantastic. The passengers all dressed to fly, and everybody treated you with a lot of respect, and the airplanes that we flew were maintained in excellent condition, which in the Air Force, you know, they're just not as professional at maintaining airplanes as airlines are. So actually transitioning to the airline business was, I loved it, because then you had a schedule, and you had a lot of time off, and you had fun when you flew, and they paid you well. So it was a lovely transition.
Now, you flew the Convair 880, didn't you?
I did, and I don't know how familiar y'all are with that thing, but it was it in its time, and in this period that I flew between 1970 and 1974. Then they got rid of them. But it was the queen of the skies. And it was a four-engine hot rod that it didn't have fan engines on it, and it blew black smoke out the noisy exhaust, and you couldn't miss it coming or going. It had four, what you, Max, as an engine man, would be a J79.
Yeah,
the same engines that were on the 104 had four of those, and
it was faster than the 707, wasn't it?
It was considered the fastest airplane in the sky, the fastest commercial airplane. So, actually, I had a funny thing happen on that airplane. I was flying with a Captain Dick Caravella and an engineer, Jake Armstrong, and. And Dick Caravella was a very professional, distinguished-looking fella, and he looked like he was in total command. And but he had a great sense of humor, and so did Jake Armstrong. And we went through Dallas and found that our flight attendants had misconnected. So we got all new flight attendants right out of training. And so Dick and I kind of looked around and thought, well, you know, we ought to do something to kind of initiate these girls. So we thought about a couple of things. So after we got in flight, this flight attendant Judy came up and asked us if we wanted anything to drink. And we were chatting a little bit, and Dick turned to Jake and he says, "Jake, check the restroom and see if anybody's in there." And Jake had on his engineer panel, he had one of those little can lights about the size of a tomato paste can. And when it's not on, it just looked like any other 1,000 things up there that she didn't know what it was. And so he put his eye up on that thing and rotated it around a little bit. And he said, "No, sir, there's not anybody in there." And she says, "You can look in the bathroom?" And Caravella says, "Well, now, don't get upset about this. We got safety items to consider. And, you know, if there's somebody in there incapacitated or something, then we need to know about it." And so she looked at Jake and she says, "But I was just in there." And he kind of looks at the floor and says, "Yes, I know." she left the cockpit red-faced, and we kind of discussed what else she might believe. When she came back up, we were all sitting there very serious, and she says, "Is something wrong?" And Dick says, "Yes, there is something wrong. Steve and I were discussing about why we had never flown together before, but turns out that both of us are takeoff pilots."
That's a great line.
She said, "Well, what does that mean?" And he said, "Well, It means that we've all been trained, both of us have been trained as to take off, but we've never been trained to land. And there's nobody on here can land the airplane. Well, we weren't sure she'd believe it, but she kind of looked skeptical. And about that time, Dick got out of his seat and went back to the engineer's panel. Well, when he got out of his seat, it triggered the high-altitude oxygen mask regulation, which means that if there's only one pilot left in the seat, he has to wear the oxygen mask. And I didn't know exactly what he was doing until it dawned on me that that mask, you could talk in it, and nobody could tell you were talking. And so he manipulated a couple of switches, and really what he was doing is he's setting the radio on the engineer's panel to intercom. And I set mine to intercom, and he said, well, he's going to call flight control to talk to him about the situation. Well, he called, and I answered his flight control. And when they came on, he told them about not having a landing pilot on board, and they said they'd study the situation. Well, now I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to say when I get back on. So in a few minutes, I came back on, and I said, Delta, this is 382, this is flight control. We've studied your situation, and you have a possibility that we might be able to help you. You have a new autopilot, a 3670 autopilot on that airplane, and it's not been certified for flying the airplane because it's got some problems. And the problem is that we think it'll land the airplane, but once it lands, 5 minutes after it lands, it automatically goes into takeoff mode. So Dick says, well, we'll try it. So she says, well, what's going to happen here? And Dick says, now, you got a responsibility to go back there and don't tell your passengers anything about what's going on, and don't tell any of the other flight attendants. We don't want anybody to be panicky or anybody to be upset. And you just stay out of the cockpit, and we'll take care of the situation, but don't tell anybody anything. So she goes on back. So after a while, we thought, well, maybe we might have overdone this a little bit. And
too late Jake, now.
Yeah, Jake looks through the cockpit door, or the peephole in the door, and he says, well, it looks to me like everybody's performing back there as well as expected. I think she's told them, and she's figured it out. So we didn't pay that much attention to it until after we landed, and she didn't get out of her seat. She just sat there, and other girls got up and started doing their after landing checklist and everything, and then all of a sudden she leaped up in the aisle and she says, "We're going into the takeoff mode. We're going into the takeoff." And other girls looked at her like she was crazy, and passengers looked a little bit apprehensive and tried to figure out what was going on. And so finally, after a few minutes, and we didn't go into the takeoff mode, she figured out what the situation was, and she got up and went back to her job.
Oh. Did the flight attendants ever get even with, you or other pilots that kind of pulled these pranks? Did you ever see that happen?
Oh yes, yes. I've seen that happen. I had a situation in Chicago one time where a flight attendant was trying to steal my pants out of my room, and she'd gotten a key because I had pulled some things on her. She had gotten a key. She got the co-pilot to go down to the desk and get the key to my room. In those days, we had our own sign-in sheet, and it wasn't as hard to get somebody else's key as you might think, because if they knew they were a crew member, they said, "I locked myself out of the room, and this is the room number," and they just hand you the key. Hmm. Well, so she tried to steal my pants out of the room. So that's a. Not quite a family story, so I'm gonna end it right there.
Okay. Steve, one of the things that we've talked about, and Rob in particular has had a lot to say about this, and also Max Trescott, And that's on the issue of automation in today's jetliners. And we've seen a lot of conversation about the pilots really need to learn to hand fly or need to spend more time hand flying the aircraft, so there's less reliance on automation and all that. Do you have any thoughts on that topic?
Yes, I do. I don't have anything against automation as such. And I know it has done wonders for close approaches. The L-1011 was not near as automated as the 767 or the 777, but it was more automated than the other airplanes that I had flown. My thoughts on it is that it's not the automation that's the problem. It's the fact that the crew members just have a tendency to depend on it too much. And then when it doesn't work like it's supposed to, they get in a jam. And a good example of that was the flight, the San Francisco flight, where they were on final approach and they thought that the ILS was out and they were making a visual approach, but they thought that the autopilot, the auto throttles were still working, even though they were hand flying the airplane. And so they got low and slow and hit the overrun on the airport. Well, it's because the guys had not hand flown enough, and they were dependent on it doing something that it didn't do. And the other example I can think of is the recent crash that plunged into the ocean of TransAsia 235 that was coming from. I think it was going to Singapore and fell into the Java Sea. Well, I'm pretty sure that airplane had pretty much the same problem as the Air France flight did. And that was an automation problem where they had ice on their pitot tubes and it messed up their computers and they got into some false signals on what their airspeed was doing and just really hadn't been trained for it. And it was associated with having that automation and the crew not responding. There was, throughout the fall of that Air France flight, it lasts about 3.5 minutes, from 38,000 feet, any time they could have recovered that airplane had they known what to do. And had they been flying an airplane that wasn't totally automated, I don't think that would have happened. So my problem with it is, and I'll give you a good example. I started thinking like I'm thinking right now back when I first transitioned into the 767. And the 767 had a glass cockpit, and it was very automated compared to anything I'd flown before. I came off of the 727, and I was making an instrument approach in the simulator, and the instructor says, "There's an airplane on the runway. You got to go around." Well, there was a couple of buttons you could push and set the airspeed, and it'd climb out, auto throttles, and the whole nine yards. It'd do its go around, but I couldn't remember exactly which buttons to push. I got confused on it because I was still in training. And so I delayed way too long. And the instructor says, "Well, you know, all you have to do is just click everything off and hand fly it." Well, of course I could click everything off and hand fly it, but I was still trying to figure out how to do the automation. So there was an example that has probably happened to other people. And luckily, Delta always flew their airplanes. They always said, and I hope they're still doing it, that when you always got to be able to turn everything off and hand fly the airplane. And when I was flying, we flew the airplane to 10,000 feet without autopilot, and we'd turn the autopilot off at 10,000 feet if the weather permitted. So we got a lot of flying experience. Some of those guys, we had an instructor that went over to fly with some of those Asian airlines, and they were scared to death if you turned the automation off, because they just didn't have enough experience of flying that they felt comfortable with. Hmm.
Yeah, Steve, but isn't that exactly the way to get that experience, is to turn the automation off and actually fly the darn aircraft?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They don't do it. You get dependent on it. And the truth of the matter is some of the carriers, I think, encourage the pilots to use the automation, because it's true that when it's working properly, it can fly better than you can. And, you know, it does a good job. I mean, you know, the L-1011, when it was all hooked up, it would fly Category 3B. I flew Category 3B approaches with it. Well, you couldn't have done it without the automation, because you had three computers were cross-checking each other, and it was this very stable platform, and it would go right down to the runway, and if you couldn't see a thing, it didn't make any difference. But you can't hand fly it when you can't see anything. So the automation is a good thing to have, but my problem with it is the pilots always have to be trained to be able to fly without it. They need to be comfortable to fly without it.
Rob, do you see, as Steve points out, Rob, there's been a number of accidents lately that, you know, kind of point to this issue of having proficiency hand flying the plane, or proficiency with situations where the automation doesn't do what you would normally expect it to do. But Rob, do you see any changes coming out as a result of all these things?
There are plans. Some of the airlines certainly have tried to institute some awareness at high altitudes of critical angles of attack and that sort of thing, and how important it is to simply get the airplane back flying, as Steve mentioned. But you know, the training in general is it still has a way to go. I mean, and certainly, too, we were mentioning some of the folks in the Asian area. We have to remember that they don't have a general aviation industry like we do, where somebody, you know, we always laugh at them and say, oh, you know, guy's going to get an airline transport pilot license, but, you know, he may have spent 1,000 hours flying around on a Cessna 172. Hmm. But they don't even have that opportunity. I mean, some of them train over here and they may get, you know, 100 hours or 150 in a small airplane, and they go back and they're in, you know, some pretty big airplanes. And so they don't, it's not just that they're frightened, you know, and I'm taking this from people I've spoken to, but I'm saying it's not just that they're plane frightened when the automation goes off. It's the fact that they don't have that depth of knowledge to fall back on and say, oh, well, I just, you know, just keep the airplane flying level, and there you go. I mean, if I leave the power alone, it's going to keep flying. They don't have that kind of experience, and that's one of the things that really worries everybody. But the long answer, the long answer to your short question was that we're not at the point yet where we have the awareness training that we need for pilots of all levels in terms of maintaining control when the automation dies.
Well, I agree with what Rod said 100%. There was when I was flying, most of the time when I was flying, the Asian airlines would only let captains be either British Airways or American. They can't do that anymore. There's not enough pilots to go around, and they have their own crews. But there was a period of time where the captain was always from the United States or from British Airways.
All right. Well, Steve, we want to make sure that we give you an opportunity to tell our listeners a little bit about the book that you've written, Wheels Up, Skyjinks in the Jet Age. I guess you could kind of categorize this as an autobiography, but it's kind of more than that, wouldn't you say?
Well, yes, it is. I wanted to tell these stories that I have in there, and they're not all funny stories. Some of them are predicaments that I got into, and some of them are serious stories, but there's probably more humorous stories than anything else. And I realized when I started to tell these things that if I didn't make it entertaining, nobody'd ever read them. I mean, people generally won't read an autobiography anyhow. And so I thought, well, if I just tell some funny stories here and there, maybe they'll read it. And it's had good response. And so I'm pleased that I've had a lot of fellow pilots that told me that I need to get these stories down or else they were going to be lost or distorted. And so I've got a lot of them down now.
And you have a website where folks can go to learn more about this?
Yes, it's very easy. It's stevetaylorbooks.com. And if you just put Steve at stevetaylorbooks.com, that's my email address. And if you want to look at the Amazon, it's got a lot of information on there about the book. And if you'll just go on Amazon Books and put Wheels Up in there, it'll bring you right to my site. It's for sale on ebook, everywhere ebooks are sold. So you can do it either way.
And Steve, didn't you tell me that if people bought it from your site that you'd actually autograph it for them?
That's correct. If they want an autograph copy, they need to go to my site and you can order it right through PayPal on my site, and I'll autograph it and mail it. Shipping's free.
Fantastic. Steve, there's dozens of other topics that we wanted to talk to you about, but time is getting a little bit short. But maybe just really, really quickly, we've talked in the past about this refinery that Delta is operating now, and wondered if you have any opinions on that.
I think that Delta has one of the finest management teams in the industry right now. That hadn't always been the case, but they've got a good team right now. And in the old days, they used to have the finest management team. And I base a lot of this on that fact. They bought the Trainer Oil Refinery from Conoco in Pennsylvania, and they're operating it by a Delta subsidiary called Monroe Energy. And they've had some people knock them on that because I saw a bad article in there. Forbes magazine wrote a bad article about it. But I don't think they fully understand the whole story because what they were trying to do is they were trying to do several things. They wanted to be able to get fuel, and they wanted to be able to cut down on what they call a crack spread between the crude oil and what it costs to refine it. And then they would make that difference. The oil refinery was using Nigerian oil primarily, which is Brent crude. So Delta, one of the things Delta did was they've been getting oil from the United States. They've been getting it through railroad cars from the Balkan fields in North Dakota, and they got Eagle Ford in Texas. They actually even bought a ship to ship their own oil from Texas. And so the reason for that is because the American oil is cheaper than foreign oil because they're producing so much of it. There's usually a spread of several cents or several dollars a barrel. So they're doing a lot of things. They have some swaps where they if they have gasoline that they're not using, maybe there's somebody in the east that needs gasoline, and then they'll trade it for some kerosene somewhere else out west. See, so there's a lot of flexibility they have by having that oil refinery that a lot of people don't understand. And so I think that it's they actually made money on the refinery last quarter. And what's caused some of the negative talk about it is people are getting confused with the oil refinery and Delta's hedging program. They've had a very aggressive hedging program, and recently it's bit them pretty bad because fuel fell so fast that they actually had to show that loss on their books. From the fact that they hedged it at a certain price and the oil was now selling for less than that price. Well, that says their fuel business, their hedging and their extra stuff was costing them more money than what somebody else would have had if they had just been buying the oil straight out. But the hedging program will – they'll get that straightened out. And so I think a lot of people are confusing the hedging along with the refinery. They're lumping it all together and saying, look, they're not doing anything. They're not making any money with that. And they do admit that it's been a learning curve, but I'm sure that they know what they're doing, and they'll come up with some great savings on that.
All right. Interesting. Yeah. A lot of times when a company sort of vertically integrates or gets into another aspect of the business that doesn't represent their core competency, oftentimes they'll fall flat because they don't have the expertise. But I don't know. It sounds like that's not quite the case here, that Delta's being successful with this interesting strategy for sure.
It is. And I think they're committed to it.
All right. Well, Steve Taylor, I want to thank you again for joining us. The book is Wheels Up, Skyjinx in the Jet Age. The website is stevetaylorbooks.com. Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
And now it's time for the airplane of the week. This episode, Jamie Dotson tells us about the Cessna 172. Here's Jamie.
This is Jamie Dotson with the Airplane Geeks Plane of the Week. This week, we're featuring the ubiquitous Cessna 172. If I could take a listener poll, I would wager that the majority of the geek audience has flown in a Cessna 172. I would further wager that most have piloted one, including me, much to the continuing night terrors of my CFI. However, measured by its longevity and popularity, the Cessna 172 is the most successful aircraft in history. According to most sources, Cessna and Rheims of France have built more 172s than any other aircraft, including commercial, military, or civilian. By my count, Cessna and Rheims have built a little over 43,000, and it's still in production. The next closest airplane is Soviet Union's IL-2 ground attack fighter out of World War II, which went out of production before Comrade Bera poisoned Comrade Stalin. The Cessna 172 started life as a tricycle landing gear variant of the tail dragger Cessna 170. In January 1955, Cessna flew an improved variant of the Cessna 170, the 170 Charlie. It had a Continental 0300A engine with larger elevators and more angular tail fin. Although Cessna tested the variant and it was certified, the company decided to modify it with tricycle landing gear. The modified Cessna 170C flew again on 12 June 1955. To reduce the time and cost of certification, Cessna added the type to the Cessna 170 certification as the Model 172. Later, the FAA gave the 172 its own type certificate, a 3 Alpha 12. The 172 became an overnight sales success. According to Cessna's records, over 1,400 were built in 1956. Its first year in production. The early 172s were similar in appearance to the 170s, with the same straight aft fuselage and tall landing gear legs, although the 172 had a straight tail fin, while the 170 had a rounded fin and rudder. Later 172 variants incorporated revised landing gear and the swept-back tail fin, which is still in use today. In the 50s, the Cessna marketing department chose to name the landing gear Landomatic. This implied that these aircraft were much easier to land and take off than conventional tail draggers. They even went as far as to say pilots could do drive-up takeoffs and drive-in landings, further implying that these aircraft were as easy to fly as driving a car. The final aesthetic development in the mid-1960s was a lowered rear deck allowing an aft window. The Cessna marketing department advertised this added visibility as Omnivision. Cessna has not changed the airframe configuration since then, except for updates in avionics and engines, including the Garmin G1000 glass cockpit in 2005. Legal entanglements and frivolous lawsuits forced Cessna to halt production in the mid-1980s. However, production resumed in 1996 with the 160-horsepower Cessna 172 Romeo Skyhawk. Cessna supplemented it in 1998 with the 180-horsepower Cessna 172 Sierra. The Cessna 172 may be modified via a wide array of supplemental type certificates, STCs, including increased engine power and higher gross weights. Available STC engine modifications increase the power from 180 to 210 horsepower, add a constant speed propeller, or allow the use of automobile gasoline. Other modifications include additional fuel tank capacity and wingtips, added baggage compartment tanks, added wheel pants to reduce drag, or a STOL kit with enhanced landing and takeoff performance for safety. Friend and two-time geek guest Igor Sikorsky III operates a modified 1968 172 India as an air carrier under Part 135 in the Maine woods out of Bradford Camps. Igor has a Penyang conversion and power flow exhaust, resulting in 180 horsepower. With a Bauman 2550 straight floats, Macaulay 8242 fixed prop, and a Sportsman STOL kit, Igor says it's a good performer. Quote, "It's a beauty. It's got simplicity, a burn rate of 9 to 10 gallons per hour, and it's easy to maintain." On October 4, 2007, Cessna announced its plan to build a diesel-powered model to be designated the 172 Skyhawk Tango Delta. The variant would use a Thalert Centurion 2-liter liquid-cooled dual overhead cam, four-cylinder inline turbo diesel with full authority digital engine control and an output of 155 horsepower burning jet fuel A. In July of 2013, Cessna canceled the model after Thalert went bankrupt. The aircraft was later refined into a turbo Skyhawk JTA. In July 28th, they announced that a diesel-powered Skyhawk would start deliveries in 2015. But with a sticker price of $420,000, I can only wonder how Cessna will market the fuel-sipping variant. In a parallel effort in July 2010, Cessna announced it was developing an electrically powered 172 as a proof of concept in partnership with Bai Energy. In July 2011, Bai Energy became Beyond Aviation and announced that the prototype had commenced taxi tests. In 2012, the prototype using Panasius batteries engaged in multiple successful test flights from Centennial Airport, Arapahoe County, Colorado. Despite major upgrades to the Skyhawk's power plant and instrumentation, the airframe design is 60 years old. A good question might be, is it still relevant? In almost every way, it's clear that the answer is yes. The two most persuasive arguments against that are it's made from old materials and it costs too much. For an airplane like the Skyhawk, all metal construction is justifiable and arguably a better option. The cost of the airplane is harder to dismiss, although it's not entirely Cessna's fault. Cessna is committed to the single-engine lineup, but like any business, each airplane must pull its own weight. I doubt that Cessna is secretly getting rich off its piston engine singles. Nor do I argue that the company should subsidize production. They cost what they cost. The bottom line is that today's Skyhawk is the best Skyhawk the company has ever made, and it is still a relevant design. But starting at $280,000 for a 160-horsepower model, we'll have to let the market decide on its future. This is Jamie Dodson sitting in for Chief Airplane Geek Historian David Vanderhoof from Huntsville, Rocket City, Alabama, and Moontown Airport 3 Mike 5.
No, thanks, Jamie. Hey, what do you guys think about the 172? You think that will live on forever?
Landomatic. I love that name.
I remember that.
It'll never fly. No, something like a quarter of all the pistons ever made by Cessna. In fact, I think a quarter of all Cessna aircraft ever built were the 172. So, yeah, it's a pretty phenomenally successful design.
Rob, you got any 172 items?
No, actually, what I was thinking is that the, will they keep making them? Well, they'll keep making them as long as people keep buying them. And despite the prices, I remember a long time ago when the price of a new Bonanza went through $100,000. And I said, wow, it's the end of days. Well, no one is going to ever be buying Bonanzas that cost more than $100,000. And of course, you know, that all changed. But so we'll see. I mean, and I guess that's all we can do is just kind of wait and take a look at the market and see what happens. And again, if people keep buying them, they'll keep making them.
Right. All right, let's move on to some listener mail. We have quite a bit, a lot more than we have time for, unfortunately, but maybe we can chip away at some of it. We did hear from Tom, who had some comments about last week's Aviation Minute. Rob, you want to kind of give us your thoughts on that?
No.
Okay, moving on to the next item.
So what do you – who knows, Tom? I mean, no, actually. It's always nice to have a comment, even if he doesn't agree with me. And Tom kind of took me to task and said that when I was blaming the regional guys, regional airline pilots, for part of why the pay is so low, he said I was being mean to them. And, you know, having been one for a long time – I mean, a regional pilot, not a mean guy – thought I better clarify that.
Yeah, just to make sure everybody understands.
Really, I think it's important. You know, we may all remember the B scale, B pay scale they tried to institute when Mr. Crandall was running American Airlines a long time ago, and it was basically a substandard wage for new people. And the union and the pilots got together and said, this is over. And that's kind of what I was trying to tell the regional pilots, is that sometimes I think they can be their own worst enemy. You know, I didn't have the benefit of anybody pointing this out to me 30-some years ago, but I still think that's the case today. So it wasn't my intention to be mean to the regional guys. It was my intention simply to make them aware of the fact that they have a lot more control over their pay than they think they do, but only if they work together.
All right. Thanks. We also heard from Arthur Rosen. This was on our conversation about the AvWeb article by Mary Grady on the FAA amending the ADS-B rule. And if you'll recall, we were talking about the implications of that for experimental aircraft. And Arthur thought that Max T, who had some comments, didn't go far enough on ADS-B out on that ruling for experimental aircraft. He says if you read it, it says that any non-TSO'd equipment has to be equal to TSO'd equipment and proven equal. Arthur says, therefore, the manufacturer would have to do everything that TSO requires, and they don't do this, or they won't do this because of cost. Therefore, the FAA ruling means nothing, as the manufacturers have stated that they won't do this. Max T, can you fill us in a little bit on this?
Well, you know, Arthur may know more about this than I do, and I was certainly open to all kinds of interpretations of this. I believe that in general, if you just look at avionics available for experimental aircraft, almost all of them are less expensive than avionics for a certified aircraft. So, you know, I believe that we'll see less expensive ADS-B solutions in experimental aircraft, but I don't know that for sure, and I could be wrong. Hmm.
And we asked Mary Grady, who wrote the article, a little bit about this, too. And she noted that this is it's a pretty confusing issue, she says. And, you know, it's tough to kind of parse through this and figure out just exactly what the implications are. The EAA commented on this and noted that in its Federal Register publication, the FAA noted that, quote, it was not the FAA's intent to arguably limit operators to only install equipment marked with a TSO. The FAA's intent was to permit equipment that meets the performance requirements set forth in the referenced TSOs. And unquote. And the EAA says the FAA further stated that the inadvertent removal of the word performance in the 2010 final rule was in error and resulted in confusion.
Which is why they rushed to clarify it 5 years later.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Right. We also heard from Rick comment on episode 335. He says, this is where we mentioned the new Air Force One airplane, the 747-8, to replace the two 747-200s that are currently in service. And we talked about that there being a requirement for a four-engine replacement. David mentioned the A380. I think it was David. The A380 and the 747-8 as being really the only two that fit that. And Rick says, hey, what about the C-17? That thing has four engines. He said it's not, while not as long, it is much wider and taller. You can customize the interior sometimes, or rather, he says, I believe the C-17 is already part of the White House airplane entourage as it hauls around the limos and other Secret Service gear. He says, I think the C-17 has also been designated as Air Force One a few times when the president was aboard. So I thought that was kind of an interesting idea. David responded back and said, well, one problem is the C-17 going out of production. He also notes that the changes required to make a C-17 an airliner would be enormous, whereas Air Force One is an airliner first, with the special stuff added second, that going the other way around, building an aircraft from scratch is kind of what would be involved here. But I think it's an interesting idea. I like Rick's thought that a C-17, boy, that would be kind of an impressive, here comes the president in Air Force One, a C-17.
Hey, well, Max, the opposite would work. I'm sorry. There's another four-engine aircraft, the A340, that no one seems to consider. Guess it must be because it's made by Airbus. But
yeah, I think that's just about the only other, Western four-engine airplane. But yeah, I think, like Dave said, you're never going to see
A380, the president. Right? Isn't that four? A380, isn't that four engines?
Yes, the A380, sure. and the A340, the two Airbus four-engine airplanes. But I don't know. I don't think we will ever see a U.S. president flying around in Air Force One that was built by Airbus. I just can't see that happening. Mike wrote us. Mike, he sent along some great photos. We're going to put these in the show notes. Mike is from Massachusetts, and he has a home-built Sonex.
Yes, it's made in Wisconsin. It's an Oshkosh-built airplane. Kit, rather.
It's a kit, that's right. And it's really a beautiful aircraft. But as many of those in the U.S. know, and certainly as those in the Northeast U.S. know, Massachusetts, along with some of the neighboring states, including mine, has just gotten hammered this year with snowfall. So Mike keeps going out, digging out his airplane, and it keeps getting buried again, and there's feet and feet and feet of snow. But he sent us a few photos of his Sonex and in the snow, and we'll put those in the show notes. Thank Mike for sending those along. If you've got an airplane, you've got an interesting story around it, or just a picture of it, maybe with you in the picture, send it to us. We'd love to see those kinds of things, and that might even find its way into the show notes. Max, we need a picture of you in an airplane.
Sure, why not?
Yeah, find something good, something flattering.
Okay, that means we'd have to find a very ugly airplane that would make me look good by comparison.
Okay. Yeah, you seem to be really uninspired by all this.
Airplanes?
No, just submitting a photograph. Yeah, yeah, you seem very just blah.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe it's because I hang around airplanes, 8-10 hours a day, and maybe I get slightly jaded.
Tired. Well, you got an email from Brett. Brett is an aerospace engineer by profession, he says. And he says he's turned his expertise and passion for STEM education. STEM. Everybody knows STEM, right? Science, technology, engineering.
Engineering and math.
Yep. And math, right. The point of this is that, ensure the future, we need, more young folks who have good, strong STEM education and view, career paths in those areas. So Brett says that he's turned his passion for STEM education into a book and a website to help young people who want to pursue a career in the aerospace and aviation field. He says there are a lot of airplane or space geeks out there, but too many of them get disinterested, distracted, or intimidated in their middle school to high school years to follow their passion and get serious about pursuing a career with it, especially girls. So to reach out to them, he says, to reduce the inertia or drag resistance along the way, he wrote this book, How to Be a Rocket Scientist. And it's an ebook and a paperback. You can find that on Amazon. And we'll put links to that in the show notes. Although the link is very simple. It's www.howtobearocketscientist.com. You can go check that out if you've got some, well, young children yourself or you know of some that might benefit from this. Take a look at it. And thanks to Brett for passing that along.
Hey, Max, that's exactly what killed my career in the STEM programs were the girls. So
the girls killed your career in STEM?
They beat you out?
Why, because they were smarter than you?
No, I was significantly more interested in them than studying.
Very good. Very good. Hey, I think Brett's done a really good thing here because I think it is so important to get people at an early age interested in engineering. And I was happy to run across a high school senior recently who's planning to become an aeronautical engineer. And I'm just wondering, is there, you know, maybe we get Brett to give us a few copies we can give away to you know, young folks that might be interested in a copy of the book?
Great idea. All right. Speaking of technology, Ray sent us a link. This is to a Flight Global article. Russian company patents lightweight GA, get ready for it, ejection seat.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Well, this Bad idea.
this is a real company, NPP Zvezda. The Russian speaking audience can help me out with that. Anyway. This thing is relatively lightweight, only weighs 16 kilograms. It uses a compressed air ram to punch you out. And I think, as most people probably know, military versions of ejection seats have a rocket or some kind of a, you know, well, a rocket, yeah, that punches you out. I don't know what the demand is for ejection seats for general aviation aircraft. What do you think, Max?
You know, I think the problem is a weight and balance issue. You know, look at a lot of the modern aircraft, and they can barely carry two people in full fuel, and this is obviously going to take up more weight. You know, and you read about people who had injuries from ejection seats. I mean, that's pretty common for people to be injured. I would much rather see a you know, full airplane parachute like Cirrus uses.
Yes.
That's been incredibly successful. And if it were my choice, I'd rather ride the airplane down rather than, you know, coming riding the ejection seat down.
I agree with you completely. David Vanderhoof had a response to this he passed along to Ray, and we'll put a link to this in the show notes. This is from a forum, a message board. It's called Vertigo, Nightmare of a SVNAF Sky Raider Pilot in the Wartime. I'm sure Steve knows what SVNAF stands for. South Vietnamese National Air Force, maybe? And what this is the story about a Vietnamese pilot who experiences vertigo, ends up becoming completely disoriented. This is while he's flying the Sky Raider, and he ends up ejecting, or at least trying to, but the system malfunctions, and he ends up partway out of the aircraft. The canopy comes off successfully. He gets punched upward a little bit, but not enough. And so he's basically riding this airplane half in, half out. And it turns out okay in the end, but the story is kind of an amazing one and interesting. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. We got some really interesting photos. Well, actually, a photo and a YouTube a video link from James in the UK. We were talking about the the C-27J Spartan last episode. I think it was last episode, and maybe it was one or two ago. And he says, this is an aircraft I've had the pleasure of watching to be displayed by the Italian test wing at Riyadh each year for the past 3 or 4 years. It's always a star of the show. So the video shows this thing doing a barrel roll, which is something that we talked about. And James also sent us a photograph that he took of a C-27J,
and inverted. And this photo has got some really, really nice propeller vortices coming around it. So it's a really fascinating, fascinating photograph. So I want to thank James for sending that along. Okay, time to wrap it up.
Yeah, an awful lot of mail this show.
I know. Well, we had a lot of great mail, and there's a lot of other mail that we received that we just don't have time for, unfortunately. But as we've said before, we do read them. We do pass them around to all the co-hosts and all. And it's just unfortunate that it's a good thing that we get so much, and it's a bad thing because we can't mention
it all. Do we have to tell people that we only read the good stuff?
Some of us only read the good stuff, and the rest of us read everything.
And, Mac, some of us don't get very much at all, so I'm going to give a plug for my own email, which is brian@airplanegeeks.com. So anyone that wants all of our episodes, the past catalog, right. I have them available. So send me an email, and we could work out the details on how to get them to you.
Very good. Thank you, Brian. So with that, that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. I want to thank you all for listening. This has been episode 337. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. If you want to go straight to this episode's show notes, that's airplanegeeks.com/337. And we want to thank our guest, Steve Taylor, author of Wheels Up, Skyjinks in the Jet Age. Check that out. And you can find more about us and our contributors at airplanegeeks.net. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. You can find him at brotherloverocks.com. Any closing comments from anybody before we put this thing to bed?
Well, actually, I just have one. I mean, Brian is just, you know, going so far out of left field there with talking about all these fantastic episodes from episode minus 43 or wherever it is he got all this stuff. I can't believe you guys didn't mention the conglomeration of my best Airplane Geeks jokes that will be out soon. But it's going to be very short. Ba-da-boom. Okay, all right, I'm sorry.
That's good.
Okay, great. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Good night, everybody.
Hey, keep the blue side up. Okay, where are you from originally?
Charleston.
I love Charleston.
Get out. I thought you were from New York from the sound of you. Steve, you ain't a Yankee.
Well, it's like, that reminds me of the story one time when I was talking to a New York controller, and he was beginning to irritate me a little bit, and so finally I says, do you hear how fast I'm talking? And he says, I do hear you. And I says, that's how fast I listen.
Well, those New York guys are pretty bad.
Very good.
I like that.
Steve, I think we're picking up from you a whole bunch of background noise.
Are you picking it up now?
Nope, not now, but it sounded like you were hammering before and moving around piles of paper and all that.
It was my chair. Okay. My chair was squeaking. I'll try not to do that.
Sit still.
You could tell that I wasn't all that interested in the frequent flyer thing because I was twirling around in my chair.